Hi everyone, welcome to Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation. My name is Florence. I am a researcher of English literature at the University of Sheffield, and I am obsessed with punctuation, and I hope by the end of a couple of episodes you will be too. My main project is on brackets in Renaissance romance, so that's stories about knights and ladies and dragons and giants in the forest, and I look at how brackets just populate those stories. But in the course of the research, I became interested in anything that has to do with punctuation in literature and then also culture. So literature and otherwise, I suppose. And that is, for instance, punctuation in law and the interpretation of laws through the presence of a comma or not. Punctuation in politics, why some languages or some cultures have taken over European punctuation. Sometimes that would support colonialism, sometimes that would subvert it, and I'm going to make an episode on that as well. Punctuation in religion, so you have punctuation in the Quran, in the Torah, in the Bible as well, and punctuation art, for instance. There are artists who use punctuation, visual artists, to create their work. So, and of course, punctuation as we use it every day, in our texting, in our emails, maybe even letters and postcards, if we still send these. Hopefully we do. So punctuation really is everywhere. And I became interested in the marks themselves, but also why we use punctuation. And how does that, how did that grow historically? Where does that come from? They didn't just appear out of nowhere the way they are now. We started out with little punctuation, and then we humans invented more and more. And the next episode is also going to be about the history of punctuation and how that grew and why we have invented it, which is also very much connected to technologies of writing. So from scroll to printing press to the computer and the web, and also what we wanted our writing to do. So from stories to letters and political messages and notes. And punctuation is really intricately involved in life, really. So the mission of these podcasts is to stop and slow down and pay attention to the really, really small things of writing, which actually turn out then to be quite big things and to have lots of impact that we don't actually realize. So I wanted to start with the question of what punctuation actually is and why might it matter. And to maybe jump the gun, I do have to say I don't know what punctuation is. If you know, please let me know. Please get in touch. I would appreciate it. Because the more I look at it and the more I try to find out about it, the less sure I am I know what it is. And I just know that it matters from the things that I will discuss. I guess this confusion is good, because when we can say what something is, then usually it's dead. But it's also not good, of course, because we need to have words to talk about something. So I guess we all know punctuation when we see it, right? Comma, a dash, brackets. But then, what about hashtags? Is a hashtag that you put on your tweet or something at the end of it, is that punctuation? Is it the same punctuation as a hyphen, for instance, or an apostrophe? And if not, what's different about it? So I think there's much more to it than we initially think, and I think that's a very productive confusion and doubt. I want to start with a little anecdote from when I was an undergrad at Cambridge. I was taught by the punctuation guru, one of the punctuation gurus, called John Leonard, and I don't think he would mind my saying so about him. He was the student of another punctuation guru, probably the guru, who wrote the first history of punctuation in the West. And John Leonard was a student, and he wrote about the bracket in 18th and 19th century literature. So just after the period I'm interested in. But none of this was clear to me yet. I was just an undergrad, confused, trying to stay alive. And we had poetry teaching with him. So he would just give us poems and just say, well, say something about them now. So that would sometimes happen like that. Sometimes they would have a theme. And one day he gave us a poem by John Clare, who is a romantic nature poet. So that's sort of, I think, late 18th century, early 19th century, if I'm not much mistaken. And he didn't have formal education, I don't think, not very much anyway. But he was celebrated as a genius, as a sort of natural nature poet. He wrote about landscape, British landscape, and the simple life of the rustic, as it were. He had an interesting life and kind of a sad one, I suppose, but that's for another day. So we got this poem by John Clare, and John Leonard, our supervisor, said to us, come back with this poem and take out all the punctuation. That was the homework. And we came back and we took out commas and full stops, the usual kind of commonplace thing that you would think punctuation is. And he returned the papers to us saying, that's not enough. Take out all the punctuation. So next week we come back and maybe we sort of changed capitals to small letters or confused. Maybe, I can't remember what we did. Maybe we took the blank lines between stanzas out or something like that. And he returned the papers to us saying, that's not it, that's not enough. Take out all the punctuation. In the end, none of us got it right, in quotation marks. Of course, there is no such thing as right, I suppose, but what he wanted us to do come back with nothing. And now, why would punctuation absence be nothing? So punctuation is commas and colons and dots and all of that, but it is, for example, also the space between words, the lines between stanzas, perhaps even the margin, the white margins of a page. And if you want to push it a little bit further, you could say punctuation is also the colored or black letters punctuating the paper. So maybe we should have come back with just a white blank paper. And even pushing that further, we could have come back with nothing, because we could have said that the paper on which the poem was written punctuates space. And although that sounds quite a quirky thought experiment, I suppose is a kind way of putting it, I think it is valid, because it really challenges us to think about the concept of punctuation, both the practice, you know, those marks that we put in and that do something, but also the general concept of what does it mean to put in any kind of mark on anything else, be it a circle or a cross on a stone, carving it on a stone, or a tattoo, or I don't know, maybe just looking at the clouds, maybe writing something into the sky with a plane. I don't know, that's still done, you know, like these exhaust fumes that then write something. So what does that mean? What does that mean to leave one's mark? And I don't want to go that far just now. I want to come back to the pragmatics, I suppose, of punctuation and writing, but I just want us to think of the sort of the crazy stuff that punctuation maybe allows us to explore as well. Now, what is punctuation? There are, I have a couple of definitions from reference works, and I think maybe just touching on them would be a good thing because they open up lots of questions that we will come back again and again and can explore. For example, the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics says that punctuation is a system of non-alphabetical signs that express meaning through implied pause and pitch shifts and other intonational features. And I thought that was a very inconclusive hands-off definition because it doesn't ever mention commas or question marks. But what it does mention is pause and tone. And when you write a sentence and you put a full stop, just the, let's say the most basic, simple, the thing that we can all agree on, you know, at the end of a sentence, you have to somehow mark that that's the end, you put a full stop. That's the pause before you start the next sentence, right? So punctuation tells us something about performance when you read aloud or when you read with a voice in your head, which most of us do, I think. There's research actually on that, that some people don't, but I think sort of 70% of us will have a voice of whatever sort in our head when we read silently. But when we read aloud, punctuation tells us where to pause. And punctuation also tells us something about tone. And tone is a very tricky thing to examine, I suppose, because it's sort of a, like when we lift our voice or hesitate or stress or maybe shout. So when we manipulate our voice, but if you have a poem or a text, then there is no recording of the voice. So how can you encode that tone, how it sounds like? You can do that, amongst others, through punctuation. So for example, the most straightforward punctuation mark suggestive of tone is the exclamation mark. Did I say that twice? I think that the most significant one, the most obvious punctuation mark is the exclamation mark. Because you show that the sentence or this word, whatever, is stressed and there's emphasis on it. Another one would perhaps be the question mark, because you lift your voice at the end of a question. So those tonal features, how it sounds like, or maybe an emotional quality, is what punctuation brings into the sort of skeleton of the text, of the alphabetical text. However, the Princeton definition does not say quite which mark. I gave examples now, but Princeton is very careful not to even give an example such as a dash or a comma. And I think that's useful that they are vague enough, but it's also not useful because we need a bit more meat, and we also can be a bit more specific. It doesn't really take away from the fuzzy edges, as it were. So I was looking at the Old English Dictionary Oxford English Dictionary punctuation definition, which says punctuation is a practice, it's an action or a system of inserting points or other small marks into texts in order to aid interpretation. That's the first part of the definition. And I want to unpick that a little bit because we have a practice, we have an action, so that's we do something to the text. It's sort of a custom and a habit, but it can also be individual, it's collective and individual. And it's a system, so there's something defined and rule-based about it, of inserting points or the small marks. So very often in the past,
you will have another word for punctuation, which is points or pointing. That probably goes back to Latin, actually. You have small marks. Now, what are these small marks that aid interpretation? Is it a little icon? Is it like an emoji? So some people will say that emoji are also punctuation. Other people will say no. I would say maybe, perhaps. Depends what we think about emoji and punctuation and what both of them are doing. So that's the question. Are the small marks? What kind of marks? And they aid interpretation. Okay, so there's some kind of steering, some kind of guidance that they give, as we had before with the Princeton definition, pausing or tone. And the Oxford English Dictionary punctuation definition goes on by saying, punctuation is a division of text into sentences and clauses by means of such marks. So, division of text into sentences and clauses. And that's very important, because one of the basic things that punctuation does is to tell us when something starts and stops. And that something is, of course, a word or a sentence. So imagine you have a line of letters without any spaces in between. And sometimes, you know, in like children's magazines, you have riddles or like little tasks where children have to mark where the boundaries of words are. So it's not jumbled, but it's like a sequence of letters, and they have to see where the syllables are, where the words are. And the next episode is going to be about the history of punctuation, so I don't want to speak about this too much now. But 2,000 years ago, for Greeks and Romans, there would be no space between words. So they would write in exactly that way that you have in those sort of sequences of letters without any spaces. So it was the task of the reader to punctuate, that is, to insert space between the sequence of letters to mark the boundaries of words. So what punctuation is making clear where the boundaries of words are, and the boundaries of sentences, for instance. So if you insert a full stop somewhere, you mark where a sentence stops and the other one starts. So punctuation is very much about, in a way, disconnecting, but also very much about connecting. And I think maybe the next definition helps us to think about connecting. The Encyclopedia Britannica says that punctuation is the use of spacing and conventional signs and certain typographical devices as aids to the understanding and correct reading, both silently and aloud, of handwritten and printed texts. So, the use of spacing, that's very useful. We have something very concrete, what I've talked about, that you use both blank space and just generally spacing in general, I suppose, sort of the layout of a text in order to make sense. And you have conventional signs. So I like that they mentioned that the signs are conventional. That goes back to the same thing as having a system of punctuation, because even though we might not quite agree whether we should put a comma here or there, there is something about custom and practice and a generalized, agreement, let's say, that, you know, I guess, even though we might not agree on a comma in a text, we might agree on a question mark at the end of a question most of the time, unless it's for some kind of rhetorical effect that we don't have it, or we want to express some kind of something about the tone. We can agree most of the time that to put spaces between words is a good thing in order to help us to read faster and to really know where the where words start and end. Sometimes that's quite confusing. That's why we have hyphens which is sort of the minus sign, let's say, which connects words very often of classical origin, for instance, hyper nervous or something, or a medical word like pre hyphen and then something else. I can't think of that now. I'm going to make an episode of about hyphens too and about the loss of hyphens, but punctuation is important to tell us what belongs together and what doesn't, and largely we sort of agree when to do it and how to do it most of the time. It also depends on the grammar of the language and the individual habits. And this definition also talks about certain typographical devices. Again, small marks that I'm not sure which ones and how they operate, but we're going to come to that a little bit later in a moment. So punctuation is marks. Punctuation helps us read because it tells us where boundaries are between words and sentences. So it divides. It also connects because it tells us what belongs together. This sentence rather than that sentence, and so on. And it tells us something about performance, about pause, and about tone. So it sort of preserves voice, and it tells us how to lift that voice off the page again when we read aloud. So I guess my own definition of punctuation, a bit more of a focused one, I would say, is to say that punctuation is a non-alphabetical sign, any non-alphabetical sign in a text. So nothing that is a letter. For example, spaces between words, paragraphs, so blank space, just absence of anything, is punctuation, because it tells us about the parcels of texts. It makes discrete boundaries and walls, as it were. Commas, of course, exclamation marks, the at symbol, asterisks, ampersands, so and, the symbol for and, hashtags, hyphens, tilts, even, you know, this sort of a wave line above a letter, which perhaps may be more familiar from Portuguese or Spanish. These all can function as punctuation. It depends on what we think punctuation is and does. And I also think it's useful to think about a subset of marks, which are a bit more specific. For example, a hashtag tells us about tone, especially nowadays, where you have the Twitter habit or Facebook habit of putting a hashtag and then a word or several words that you can kind of capitalize in order to make them more readable. For example, you put something on Facebook about a bad service of your telephone provider, and then you put a hashtag disappointed or something like that. Or it might be a hashtag of a sarcastic comment. For instance, sad, hashtag sad, or hashtag bigly, or whatever, to make fun of something or someone or some kind of cultural comment. I wouldn't call the hashtag used in that way punctuation. It is a mark of punctuation, but I'm not sure if it's punctuation itself, according to what I'm going to talk about in a minute. It does tell us about tone, perhaps, in retrospect, because you make what you have said ironic in retrospect. So it does tell us something about feeling, and it does encode voice, maybe a mocking voice in the sentence. But some people might disagree and say it's more a phenomenon of writing, it's an adjunct, it's a digital phenomenon. It tries to to make clear irony, rather than tell us about how to pause, for instance. So a subset, I think, of the punctuation marks that I have mentioned could be spaces, the full stop, the semicolon, the colon, the dash, exclamation mark, question mark, brackets. And I think these belong into a subset because they really engage with this aspect of punctuation that clarifies boundaries and that tells us what belongs together, that tells us about grammatical relationships in a sentence, and that tell us about rhetorical performance or the rhetorical identity of a sentence, let's say. So is it shouted? Is it a question? Are there certain pauses? Is the person maybe reminiscing and just letting their thoughts flow out without really a full stop, if it's just, you know, a series of semicolons or something like that? So you have punctuation marks which engage very much with the grammar of punctuation, with the grammar of a sentence. So what belongs together? It clarifies relationships. Very many times it doesn't clarify, but for now, let's go with the clarification part. And those punctuation marks tell us about the effect of what has been said, the voice, the tone, the emotion with which it has been said. And I don't think that an at symbol can really do that. I don't think that an asterisk tells us how a sentence sounds like if we say it out loud. And so I think it's useful to have different levels of punctuation or have different definitions that are valid at the same time. So I think what's important from all of those definitions is that, firstly, it's clear what punctuation is and it's not clear. Then punctuation helps us read. It helps us make reading more easy and faster. And it's about interpretation as well, because we have to sort of put us into the sentence and see what that question mark means or what that pause could mean. It's a system and it's a convention, so that there's something about it that can be regularized or that is in touch with rules. But then very quickly we will notice that it just transcends those rules all the time, and it actually doesn't clarify. It creates a lot of ambiguity. And this is what these podcasts are also about, to explore where punctuation is actually way more wayward than any grammarian or dictionary writer would like it to be. David Crystal is a very prominent linguist, and he has a pragmatic approach to language and also to punctuation, which is full of enthusiasm and curiosity about the liveliness of language always changing and how we make it change. And he says the punctuation cannot be understood in isolation, so we need to look at what's the text doing, what is it supposed to do, what about the layout, what about the color of the letters or the capitalization or the spelling, and what about the time in which it was written. So I think starting out from punctuation, we can really zoom out, and we just need to put together a mosaic of so many things in order to sort of do justice to all the stuff that interplay in a text. Now, why would this matter at all?
Why should we be interested in spaces between words, in absences, in dots and dashes? I think everybody has who has a phone and is texting or has ever sent a text or a message on Facebook or a tweet or even an email, I think all of us have dashed off messages without punctuation or without a lot of punctuation, maybe with spaces between words, but certainly not with a full stop at the end. For instance, are you coming at 8? Or should we have pizza for dinner? Or shut up, right? So when we dash off quick messages, we don't usually pay a lot of attention to punctuation. So why should we? If we understand sentences mostly without punctuation, then why should we take care? And these podcasts want to convince that we have to take care, we should take care, because stopping and having a look at what we do, whether we use punctuation or we don't use it, tells us about something, where we are going as cultures, as societies, and sometimes it can be vital in the interpretation of words and of writing. For example, the most common example that everybody knows when I mention punctuation, that it is a matter of life and death, is let's eat grandma and let's eat grandma. So let's eat, comma, grandma, and let's eat grandma. If you are cannibalistically inclined, the letter, the second example will make a lot of sense to you. But there's also more to punctuation than those examples, however funny they are. For example, when punctuation becomes an issue when you want to get paid, or when you are being threatened with execution. And I just want to focus on the second example. And I want to tell the story of Roger Casement, who was an Irish consul to the British Empire. He was working in the Foreign Office, and he was in Africa and in South America. In Africa, he wrote a report about the treatment of people in the Congo by the Belgian colonialists. And this report really went viral, and he became quite famous and quite well respected in terms of human rights and in a sort of early struggle for independence and for decolonialism and the rights of people. And so he also wrote a report about not just Belgians but also the British in South America, in Peru, where native people of Peru were working on British rubber plantations and being very badly treated. Interestingly, this report didn't get quite so much attention, and we can ask ourselves why that might be. And in all his work, Roger Casement saw the struggles of peoples who are oppressed. And he, of course, also saw his own people being oppressed, the Irish. And so he joined the struggle for independence. He, when the First World War broke out and the United Kingdom or the British Empire was at war with Germany, he went to Germany and he tried to engage Irish prisoners of war in Germany for the cause of Irish independence. So he tried to recruit them as fighters. So, I mean, that means that he had to not collaborate with the Germans, I suppose, but he had to find ways of getting into the camps, into the prisoner of war camps, and talking to his Irish compatriots.
And then he was apprehended by British intelligence and he was in prison and he went on trial for treason. And the act that was that applied in his situation was the 1351, so the Medieval Treason Act, which reads thus. It's quite tricky. I'm just going to read it and then unpick it a little bit. Even when you read it, you're like, what the hell is going on? So according to this Medieval Treason Act, treason means if a man do levy war against our lord, the king in his realm, or be adherent to the king's enemies in his realm, giving to them aid and comfort in the realm or elsewhere, and thereof be properly attainted of open deed by the people of their condition. It really took me ages to understand quite what belonged to where, and to sort of wrap my head around things. But I think it means that anyone is attainted, so it's also a traitor if you rub shoulders with traitors. And the question is where you do that. In the realm, but also abroad, so elsewhere. And the punctuation, which of course you can't see because I haven't read it out, is the punctuation is the issue here. Because it creates ambiguity rather than alleviate it. So Casement's defense was that the clause or elsewhere only pertains to aid and comfort, not be adherent to the king's enemies. So Casement didn't give them money, he didn't support them in any way, but he was adherent to them. So he was in touch with the Germans, who were the enemies at the time. And this clause is separated with a comma. So that means if he was rubbing shoulders with Germans in the British Empire, in the within the bounds of it, that would have been treason. But since it was elsewhere, meaning in Germany, it wasn't treason. I think it's very, very ambiguously phrased, and the punctuation really does not help to make it any clearer. But his defense tried to use the punctuation to say, well, since it was elsewhere, meaning in Germany, the treason just pertains to aiding and comforting rather than adhering to. Now, this was not enough for the judges, and they actually found Casement guilty of treason and they hanged him. It is said that he was also had bad cards at surviving or having his judgment turned to life imprisonment, because diaries were found called the Black Diaries, which detailed in quite explicit nature homosexual acts of him and young men, different kinds of men. And of course, at the time, homosexuality was still against the law, and it just threw a bad light on him. So some people say, some researchers say, those diaries were fraud, and they were produced in order to sort of blacken his character. Others say they were genuine. But in any case, I guess public opinion turned against him in the end, and the opinion of the judges turned against him. And the defense's use of a comma of punctuation wasn't strong enough to get him out. And he himself then said in his last word, "God deliver from such antiquaries as these to hang a man's life upon a comma and throttle him with a semicolon." And I think this really very poignant case of somebody who is fighting for freedom and against oppression, and then hinging on the interpretation of law on through punctuation, really brings home how important it is to interpret properly or to clarify the meaning, but also how slippery that is and how very difficult and nearly impossible to fix this very fluid thing, I suppose, just for want of a better word, that language is, whether it be spoken or written. Punctuation helps us, and it also complicates, as we have seen, and I'm going to explore those complicated cases and also those easy cases in the podcasts. I guess I'm looking forward to paying attention with listeners. I'm inviting listeners to pay attention with me and to stop and to think about where do those signs come from and how are we going to use them in the future? How are we using them? How are other languages using them? How am I using them? I would like listeners to go away and to look at their texts and find out what, you know, are they never using full stops or are they using them in certain incidences? I won't make podcasts on a regular basis, but just when I think I have something interesting to say, because I don't think I'm reacting to anything urgent in the world, although I think punctuation is urgent. So I just want to take a bit of time and I want people to take time and to pay attention to those small things. I think it's good to slow down, and I think these podcasts are just to build a library. I will make sure to upload something once a month to just kind of keep creating content. So I want to bid goodbye for now, and I hope that people will listen to the next episode when it's up, which will be about tracing the beginnings of punctuation and of writing itself. Hi everyone, welcome to the second podcast of the series Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation. This episode is called Mind the Gap, the History of Punctuation from Classical Times to the Renaissance. And I was supposed to record a very long but very potted history of punctuation in the West. But I thought rather than have a 90-minute podcast or me rambling on, I would cut things up and make it shorter and sweeter and have perhaps two or three parts, depending on, I guess, where my thought goes. So this part is from, I guess, the Greeks and the Romans to around 13th century, 14th century. And I thought it was a natural sort of pause, a natural, let's say, semicolon provided by the invention or the popularization, I guess, of the printing press in 1450 or in the second half of the 15th century. Because from then on, just the ability, the spreading of the word and of printing, and with that also of punctuation, takes on a whole different level, which is probably comparable to our digital age. So I think, I don't know yet, but it might be worthwhile to then also have a break, another comma or semicolon, just before the internet is being invented, and which actually, or just popularized, which would be the sort of 90s, early 2000s. Because really the internet, at least the widespread use of the internet and of texting and messaging and digital and instant messaging is quite young. But this remains to be seen. So for now, this podcast is about the early history of punctuation in the West, I do have to say. From classical times to the Middle Ages, and I will call it Mind the Gap because it's all about pausing. I mean, generally punctuation is of course all about pausing, but this is about the introduction of early pauses. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about
grammar and speech and recording of speech, turning that into writing. Although I promised there won't be much grammar in these podcasts, but we do need to engage a little bit, and perhaps we can kind of punctuate the or not punctuate the or not you know, put a hole in the awe that we have of grammar by saying that I think it's actually quite you know, up to a certain degree vague discipline in terms of what language does and what we do with language. But we can just dip our feet into that a little bit, or we have to. But I want to start with an anecdote again from my student days. And I was trying to earn some money, you know, just like £5 to have an evening meal. So I went to lots of experiments, and one was in music, in the music department. And we were supposed to listen to music that was unfamiliar to us for probably 1.5-2 hours. So that happened to be a certain kind of Chinese music, I think. And you always had to press a button when you thought that a section had stopped and a new one was starting, or when you thought that something had repeated itself, which is a little bit tricky, I think, because how can I project that into the future? But the point, I think, of that experiment was that being unfamiliar with this musical, this cultural background of that particular music, it would be hard for the person doing the experiment to know when a section has stopped, because music, at least parts of music, or what music is not biological but cultural. And something similar happens in language too, because now that I'm speaking, because you know English, you can tell when a certain word starts and stops. Although you don't know what I'm saying, but you can still make sense of what I say without having a visual flash or whatever when a word stops. And this is actually a sort of miracle of the human brain, because that moment when one word stops and another starts, in linguistics is called juncture. And we don't need any signposting in language to know when a word stops and starts. And that comes with a certain familiarity in the specific language. But it also, there's also a certain kind of biological substrata, I guess. Although there are funny gaps of funny possibilities with this juncture, which of course are exploited by comedians and sketch makers. For instance, there's, I don't know, I can maybe link it or something, a sketch where a man goes into a shop. It's from the 60s British sketch, and he goes into a shop and he says, I want to buy four candles. Yeah, I want to buy four candles. And the guy gives him four candles to light. And he says, no, four candles. And then he goes back and he gives him fork handles to dig in the garden, or to, I don't know, to eat or whatever. So this kind of continues. There's lots of other words that sound similar. So it's quite hard to tell the difference if you just have that word or those two words, not in a context, but even just a sentence. There's no difference, I guess, that we are conscious of between four candles and four candles, right? I mean, one can stress, now that I'm self-conscious, I can stress it in different ways. But there's plenty of other examples. For instance, I think we all know that ice cream and ice cream. Again, it's a question of stress, but I could just as well say ice cream and I'm shrieking, but it sounds like ice cream. And something else, another example would be that stuff and that's tough. So that stuff and that's tough. So there's plenty of opportunity to make jokes, and to just explore that beauty of that ambiguity, I guess, between words and pauses, and what the brain is doing at that point, and also the necessity to have context, and especially in spoken language, to have pitch, gesture, facial expressions, and so on. And from juncture, one easily arrives at turn-taking, which is what we do when we have a conversation. So whilst we are talking, we constantly guess when the other person is probably ending their speech, let's say, their utterance, and we can start. And of course, there's a lot of slippage and a lot of possibilities and problems in those transitions. We can interrupt somebody, the pauses can be too long. So there's a lot of exciting stuff that can happen in that tiny, tiny gap between me ending and you beginning. But generally, turn-taking does have a biological phenomenon, because in most languages in the world, the pause between, in the flow of a conversation, the pause between one person stopping and another interlocutor starting is 200 milliseconds. And the margin between, let's say, Danish and Korean might look a lot if it's, you know, if it becomes a couple of more milliseconds, but it's actually quite similar. So you do have some languages that take a bit more time in quotation marks, but taking a bit more time is really relative in that context. So we do that incredibly fast, and we guess and we project and we predict the future, or when the other person has stopped speaking or is going to stop speaking. And just to compare that a little bit, it takes three times the amount of that pause when we sort of step into that gap and we take the word. It takes three times more, namely 600 milliseconds, for us to retrieve a word from memory. And it takes another double of that, almost three times the amount, 1,500 milliseconds, to bring that word from memory onto our tongue to be able to speak it. So that means that whilst the other person's talking, we constantly integrate all the messages that we get from the words, the meaning of the words, the behavior, the posture, the tone, the facial expression, the gestures, and so on. We constantly have that feedback, and we prepare our response while the other person is still talking. And that doesn't mean that we don't engage with what they are saying, but it just means how incredible the brain is, that it's, we can just multitask in that way, and we can react so very quickly. Why have I said all of those things? Who wanted to speak about the history of punctuation, the early history? Because in language, we don't need any signposting to know, if we are familiar with the language, when somebody has when a word stops and another starts. But in writing, if we wouldn't have spaces and if we wouldn't have punctuation, it would be quite hard for us to figure out the endings and the starts of words, as I've mentioned before, when sometimes in like a children's magazine or a page of riddles in the newspaper, we have those words bunched together. It does take a bit of time to figure out the syllables and the boundaries of the syllables. So we are really adept at telling those boundaries in talk, but the eye and the brain take a long time to figure that out in comparison when we just bunch words together in writing. And so I just wanted to start with that thought, that writing needs assistance, needs crutches, as it were, to do the thing that we're actually really, really good at when it comes to talking. And this is sort of the main thought for this part of the history of punctuation. And kind of a leading question is that moment where speech becomes translated into writing, and how can we then make clear that thing that we do very well when we talk? That's sort of the main leading question. And then spinning off of that would be, what are the concepts of writing? What do you think writing is supposed to do? Is it a representation of speech? Is it a representation of thought? What are we using it for? And how are we reading? Are we reading out loud? So do we retranslate it into speech, or are we reading silently just in our minds? Maybe with a voice in our minds again. And then also the question of grammar and rhetoric. So grammar, the structure of sentences and the relationships between words and phrases, and rhetoric, a sort of general understanding of that, or like a working definition that I would put, is the effect of pausing, the rhythm, the intonation, the voice, the performance when we speak out loud, or when we speak out loud in our heads, I guess. So these are sort of the leading questions for this short history. And I mentioned juncture and turn-taking and bunching words together because this is how the Greeks and the Romans write. So I've been trying to find out whether cuneiform and hieroglyphs had punctuation. I'm not quite sure yet. I read different things. But these early writings are, I guess, something else. So for now, I want to start with Greek and Roman writing, because for the classical times, for ancient Greeks and Romans, writing was a record of speech more than it was a record of thought. So you would be writing in order to give a speech, and writing was understood as a representation of thinking. Mind you, somebody like Cicero, the great Roman orator, would probably rework his speeches. But the main concept was that writing was a representative of voice. And I think that is important because the writing that happened in Greece and Rome was called scriptio continua, so continuous script. So there were no spaces between words, and there was hardly any punctuation. There was a certain amount, I guess, of a realization of paragraphs, but mostly no spaces. And the Greeks as well had a period of writing in boustrophedon, so they would go from left to right, and then in that line they would just drop to the next line at the end of that line and go from right to left and then drop again and go from left to right. So quite challenging for the eye to be reading that and to make sense of that multilinearity, as it were. So to take with us from that part, Greeks and Romans would be bunching the words together, and they would just write in capital letters. Perhaps also because they would carve in stone, and you can't carve all those round, minuscule letters that we have today, but that came way, way, way later, in stone very easily. So carving in stone would be a bit angular, perhaps. So they would be writing in capital letters, which of course in hindsight is capital, but not at the time. They were the only letters, and they write without any punctuation, without any spaces in between. What does that mean for a person reading? So you wouldn't be able to read out loud if you get a piece of writing and you were unfamiliar with it. And there's an anecdote that I should dig up of somebody, a politician, and people give him they shove a text into his
hands, and there's lots of people standing around. So this was in Rome, classical Rome, and they say, read that out loud, that speech. And he is very sort of ashamed because he says, it's not pointed. I can't read it. I would make a mess of it. And so you had to sit down and prepare what you wanted to say and how you would want to pronounce certain words. And those were very individual, or probably individual and idiosyncratic marks. Same as today when we have, we give a talk, then we might have a system that's very individual, how you want to stress something or pause, different degrees of pauses. And the same happened in Greece and Rome, where the text would come to politicians or orators naked of punctuation. Also because, as we will realize in these podcasts, punctuating means interpreting. And so if you had a scribe that maybe used to be a slave or that's just working for probably his master, maybe her, I read that there are also female scribes, but their master or their another a person higher up the social echelon, they wouldn't be allowed to punctuate because that means interpreting. And so Roman writing is without a lot of interference, let's say. That another reason why that might even be possible without a super great amount of confusion is because Latin is very strongly inflection based, and so you will be able to make sense from a sentence that is perhaps seems a little bit jumbled from our point of view of English, which has a very relatively strict word order. But because in Latin you can make sense from the parts of the sentence through their cases, through their suffixes and so on, it perhaps allows for greater understanding of the writing without punctuation. And just as a little bracket, I have a very erudite friend from India, and he said that Sanskrit also doesn't have punctuation, or original Sanskrit, old Sanskrit, because, and that's these are his words, it's like German and Latin on cocaine. It has so much control over the language in terms of the syntax, in terms of inflection, so grammatical cases, that basically it sort of doesn't need doesn't need punctuation as crutch for reading. But still, I think even a well-versed Roman would perhaps be able to make sense with just looking at an unfamiliar text, as becomes clear in that anecdote. Now, just to backtrack a tiny bit, Greeks also had that scriptio continua, but in the 3rd century BC, so I don't know, maybe was it 200 years before, 100 years before Roman sort of dominance, I guess, in the Mediterranean. A librarian of the library at Alexandria, that very famous huge library called Aristophanes, invented punctuation, which then got lost. But what he invented was a system of dots that would correspond to the units, the grammatical units of the sentence, or the rhythmical units of the sentence. It's quite messy and muddled, but there would be no spaces between words still, so you would still have bunches, but there would be dots at the different levels of the line, so at the bottom, in the middle, and on on top, depending on what unit these words belong to. And that was classical syntax, which more or less thinks about a sentence as a unified whole. So it's where the grammar is complete and the sense is complete, and that would be called the period,
We still have that today, or at least it was very much around in Shakespeare's time or in the 18th century, where you have periodic, I think, syntax, where the sense is very suspended and just comes at the very end of the sentence. So you will have a lot of although, however, when. So dependent clauses start the sentence that are whose meaning only becomes clear when the main clause arrives at the very end. And in doing so, the writer has a lot of possibilities to manipulate meaning and bring stuff together, maybe create a certain rhythm and create suspense as well, and really sort of scaffold their sentence and I guess the pace as well of the reading, be it read out loud or silently or just with the eyes or so. So in periodic writing, there's a lot of gracefulness, I suppose, in terms of structuring. And the main thing to take from periodic writing means that the sentence, you need to wait until the very end to make sense of the sentence, in sort of hindsight almost. And so in classical times, you had that period, that whole unit of sense for one sentence, and then that was subdivided into colons. I don't know the correct plural, but I don't want to be too picky. I'll just say colons. So you had colons where the sense was complete and the grammar too, but there was still something missing. So there was still some kind of continuation or some possibility to continue, sort of a bit like today where we might as well put a full stop. But there's sort of the different shorter sentences kind of hang together, so we would maybe put a colon. And those colons had, again, shorter clauses within them, as it were, and that's the comma. And it's not, if I say colon and comma and period, I don't mean those very signs that we use today, like the two dots or the little hook, but all the words as a unit were thought of as a comma. That was the name for the whole unit. In this sense, a comma, where the sense is not complete and the grammar is not complete. And then a colon where the sense is potentially complete, but and the grammar definitely is. And then the whole period where you have complete sense, complete grammar, made up of those smaller units. Now, that was a digression. How do I get back to what I was before, where I was? So Aristophanes wanted to signal the rhythm in speaking out and pronouncing and reading great literature, for instance, and mostly came up with his system of dots for foreigners, for non-native speakers of Greek. And it also, I think already back then in the 3rd century BC, there was a drive to preserve those great stories, those great works that was generally the task of the library in Alexandria. And so he comes up with these, what I call distinctions, so these dots at different levels of the line, and also a sort of paragraph, a concept of the paragraph, which was marked with horizontal signs in the margin, or sort of lines, horizontal just slashes, lines, I guess. But this invention was conveniently forgotten by the Romans, and they sort of went back to what was there before, which is scriptio continua. No such thing as dots, although you know, they were still sort of kicking around, and there were some dots in stone carvings, but I can come back to that for another podcast, because runes, interestingly, Celtic runes also have dots in their stone carvings. So, that was Aristophanes, 3rd century BC. Then we go back, we have scriptio continua again. And as the Roman Empire slowly disintegrates, knowledge of Latin, or at least classical Latin, starts to wane too. So fewer and fewer people are able to read those great writings of the sort of recent past. So in, I guess, the kind of 6th, 7th century, 8th century, there was a push by theologians or by educators, by grammarians, to preserve the meaning of those great writings. And of course, also by then, sort of the early Middle Ages, you have the Bible, the scripture, which, you know, puts premium on the text. And it's hugely important that there's no ambiguity in the text, because it's the word of God. So you had better fix that meaning. And how can you fix meaning? Through punctuation. So I guess there's a double speed or a parallel activity in terms of fixing the word, because it's the word of God and we need to be really, really clear what it means and what it says, and not leave any space for ambiguity. And then preserving those revered classical texts. And so, certain monks in scriptoria, in sort of writing workshops, let's say, in monasteries, were singled out to keep pointing, keep preserving the punctuation of old works that they were copying onto parchment. I think papyrus by that time was pretty much not used anymore, although there was a lot of overlap too. But let's say they're scratching on, or they're writing on parchment, and they would copy texts, meaning they would put the punctuation into a text that was copied by somebody else potentially. And this was an admired task. So you would be singled out because of your knowledge of grammar to punctuate. But because the skill, Latin skills, kept being on decline, a certain Isidore of Sevilla, who was a church, massive, big scholar, church father, theologian, savant, all around savant, he proposed to go back to the pointing system, the distinctions of Aristophanes. And he just redistributed the dots on the line. And he made it very clear that these are largely grammatical divisions. In Aristophanes' time, there was still this sense of this is for rhythm, and this is for speaking out loud. And by the time of Isidore of Sevilla in the 8th century, no, 7th century, sorry, there was already a silencing of the word to a certain degree, and a prominence of grammar to think about punctuation or think about the text. And up to that time, people were probably read out loud when they were reading, even when somebody was in their own room. I think there is an anecdote where somebody came into the cell of St. Augustine, another huge church father, I think 3rd or 4th century, I can't quite remember, but definitely earlier than Isidore. And this person later said that they were shocked because St. Augustine was only reading with his eyes and not with his voice too, although he was alone. And that was kind of a revelation, as it were, that was also possible. So people really connected reading with speaking. But by the time, as time goes on and writing in general becomes more more maybe intellectualized, or maybe retreated from public life, as it was very much the case in ancient Greece and Rome. People think of writing as not just a representation of speech, but also as a representation of thought that can also be produced and consumed silently. And so there is a movement from thinking about punctuation as helping you to speak out to punctuation as helping to make sense of something potentially unfamiliar. And so Isidore of Sevilla in the 7th century writes his Etymology, is a very big and very, very influential work on, I guess, a dictionary or a lexicon, rather. And he says that we should punctuate, going back to those dots from Aristophanes, just redistributed. And he also mentions the dipple, which is something like, oh, I don't know, it's like a V, just horizontal. And that people would put that if they wanted to mark that a certain line as a quotation, which is, of course, super important when you think about the Christian context where people would quote from the Bible and then write a commentary on it. So they had to make sure that they marked that particular portion out as coming from the Bible as being a quotation. So they used those sort of V-shaped horizontal shapes in the margin. That's called the dipple. So Isidore mentions that too. He also mentions the question mark. So by the 7th century, there was already a kind of arsenal, a kind of repertoire of marks. But it was really a very patchy, very uneven, I don't even want to say development, but there is some kind of development and some kind of change in concepts and practices and habits and things. But there was a lot of overlap and a lot of idiosyncrasies. Some writer would put the dot a little bit higher, a little bit lower. And just with us, our handwriting is different. And maybe somebody would just today write an exclamation mark a little bit in the shape of a question mark and so on. So nowadays, of course, when we go back, it makes it a little bit hard to trace histories and to create narratives and create stories around that. But that's sort of more or less the path, I suppose. And something to mention still is that there were still no spaces between words. So even Isidore in the 7th century, going back to Aristophanes from, 600, 1,000 years, how many years? Yeah, 1,000 years, 900 years earlier, still doesn't think that one can mark the, or one has to mark the beginning and the end of a word. Still, it's still a very grammatical kind of thinking, and some words are still bunched. And but that wouldn't need a long time. We don't have to wait for long, because just 100 years or so afterwards in Ireland, some monks are also copying texts, but they find it quite hard to get the Latin. And that's called parsing, when you have to find out the structure of the sentence through looking at the grammatical endings and what kind of part of speech that word is. That's called parsing. So these monks find it quite hard to parse Latin. So what they do, even in this system of like of dots and stuff, what they do is to just put a tiny little bit of space between the words. It's so easy, but it's a huge leap of development and of invention, really. And from then on, the sort of the spaces between words is spread throughout manuscripts, and that starts to be done too. Not to the same degree, there are different levels of spacing, but sometimes quite close together, because parchment might be wear, or the writing might have a certain kind of beauty. The more the denser together, the more beautiful. The more dense, the more beautiful. But the spaces were being invented, really, in this leap of invention, because people wanted to be able to read, I guess, faster, better, more clearly, and not have this task of having to find out the grammar, so that they could just catch the word and the sentence or the comma and the colon faster with one glance of the eye. At the same time, also in the 8th century, you have the empire of Charlemagne, and he has
an advisor called Alcuin, and he was a monk from York. I think he was bishop, probably even of York. And he came to Charlemagne and wanted to have him because he was such an educated man, and he had him as his tutor for his children. And Alcuin also helped spread the point system of Isidore, or Aristophanes, as it were, going back to that even. And what he did was to invent minuscules. So until that time, people would write in capital, what we now think of as capital letters. And what he did was to, I'm not an expert on that particular script or development, but he helped instigate or institute minuscule writing. And that is another push towards more legibility, more space, I guess, in the writing, to have more marking again, because if you capitalize everything, like when we shout today in our text messages, it becomes hard to read, and it becomes, imagine that all of this bunched together, it becomes even harder to read. So sometimes when we hashtag, we want to make sure that people can read maybe the 3-4 words that we hashtag together, and then we capitalize them, even though they might not usually be capitalized like A or the. So capital and minuscule letters also help in one word or in one sentence help reading and help catching the sense in one glance, as it were. So that's more or less it for the very early history of punctuation in the West. So we have, as a recap, we have writing bunched together, written in just a continual line, two inventions of dots to mark grammar, Aristophanes from the 3rd century before Christ in Alexandria, and that gets forgotten again, so Romans go back to the bunching together, and slowly we move into Christian Europe, where sense needs to be fixed. So a return or a revival of those dots from back then, and eventually the invention and the introduction of spaces between words, all in the name of legibility, in the name of better, faster understanding, and in the name of fixing words or meanings. And with that, one can read a change in concept of what writing is and writing is supposed to do, and what reading is and is supposed to do. So I guess this was longer than I had intended it to be, but this is the first part, and the second part will pick up on that and start in Italy in the 13th, 14th century with more inventions such as the exclamation mark and the brackets, which are very close to my heart. And then we move into the time of the printing press up to sort of, I guess, 1980s, going up to the Xerox machine or the typewriter, all of those different kinds of technologies that we have that it's important to look at too, because they also have impact on what kind of punctuation we use or how we use it. So that was it for part one. So I hope that when you write now, you can mind those gaps that we so seemingly naturally and without thinking put into our writing, which is, you know, the most basic of gaps is just the space between two words. And I hope that you appreciate the amazing nature of the human brain when we talk and we can tell when a word stops and starts. So see you next time for the second part of the history and culture of punctuation.